have to give a big shout out to the NHS, especially the Christie. Mike and I are actually really lucky, and in a very bizarre way, the last 5 months have kind of been the best months of our lives as well.
Wow, what a thing to say. Yeah. So much love for you on the text. Phil in Shropshire says, love the alarm since the 80s. Going to see Mike in Wolverhampton next year. All being well, he's a legend.
I'll survive for that, don't you?
Keep in touch. It's been amazing meeting both of you.
Thanks,
what
guys.
A message of hope.
You Thank take you very care, much indeed.
The Voice of the UK. This is 5 Live Drive.
Good afternoon, it's Claire McDonald and Johnny A. Anson on Drive. 5 o'clock on Monday afternoon. Here are your headlines. Reports from the US suggest Israel is planning to start a limited ground invasion of Lebanon. CBS News is reporting a US official as saying the next stage of action against Hezbollah could begin as soon as later today. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bechega has told Drive Israel is showing no sign of backing down.
I don't think there's any surprise here. All indications coming from Israel were towards, you know, the possibility of a ground operation in southern Lebanon. The Israelis have been saying that they want to allow the return of those 60,000 residents who have been displaced from communities in northern Israel. And military officials have been saying that the intention here is to create a so-called buffer zone in the south.
Hezbollah says it's ready to fight against any invasion. Amanda Abington says she feels vindicated by the findings of a BBC review into complaints she made about her Strictly Come Dancing partner Giovanni Pannicci. The corporation upheld some of the actor's claims, but also cleared Mr. Pannicci of the most serious allegations. The BBC's chief content officer, Charlotte Moore, has given her response to the findings.
We didn't feel that the behaviours met the standard that we would expect, and that's why some of the complaints have been upheld. If you're asking me, was it physical aggression? I think I can categorically say no. But I do want to apologise on behalf of the BBC to Amanda, and I also want to thank her for having the courage to come forward.
The four candidates wanting to replace Rishi Sunak as Conservative leader have been told they need to acknowledge how bad things are by his predecessor, Liz Truss. The former Prime Minister has spoken at the party conference in Birmingham. Tom Tugendhat and Kemi Badenoch have addressed members today before Robert Jenrick and James Cleverly get their chance to do so tomorrow. The UK's top civil servant has announced he's resigning from the job for health reasons. Simon Case first became Cabinet Secretary in 2020, September of that year. And the remaining blast furnace at Britain's largest steelworks is about to shut down. The Tata plant in Port Talbot is moving to greener technology at the expense of more than 2,500 jobs. Stuart Phillip has worked at the plant for 27 years.
We're still awaiting to find out if or where we will be redeployed and what the final sort of figures and opportunities of the voluntary redundancy look like. It's a very sad time, really.
And new figures show UK house prices rose by 3.2% this month compared with a year ago. The Nationwide Building Society says annual growth is at its fastest rate for nearly 2 years. That is your news. The sport comes from Delith.
Arsenal defender Jurrien Timber says the current fixture schedule is dangerous and is a big topic in the dressing room. The Dutchman agrees with Manchester City defender Rodri and Liverpool goalkeeper Alisson's assessment that there are too many games ahead of tomorrow's Champions League match against Paris Saint-Germain. Timber says players were definitely more at risk of a serious injury as a result of the schedule. Erik ten Hag has the backing of his bosses for the time being. The Manchester United manager will remain in charge for this week's games away to Porto in the Europa League and at Aston Villa on Sunday. The pressure, though, continues to mount on ten Hag, with the club 12th in the Premier League after 3 defeats from 6. And British number 4 Sonai Kartel told the BBC she's determined to make a big move up the rankings before Christmas. Kartel won her maiden WTA Tour title in Tunisia a fortnight ago, cracking the world's top 100 for the first time on the back of it.
A look at your travel. So quite a lot of heavy rain still out there, mainly affecting the northwest and most of Yorkshire. And the M62, we've had a breakdown at Chainbar at 26, so it's westbound. There was a lane closed there. All lanes are open. The queues go back to 27 at Gildersham. The M6, so in the West Midlands heading south, that's where the lorry was taking up two lanes. It had broken down near Junction 10 at Walsall. So the queues are still there, backing up to the M54, Junction 10A on the southbound M6. M25 queues along the bottom at 6 at Godstone after the accident in the roadworks. It's queuing back to 28 at Reigate. The A1M queuing northbound, north of Bradbury at Junction 60. That's the bridge repairs. One lane closed there. They're only temporary ones, though. Quite a lot of localised flooding. Crosby Road South, the A565, is now blocked because of floodwater near Knowsley Road at the A566. That's in Liverpool. And then Kempston, the A421. Now, this road is still they're still at the scene, basically trying to pump this water away. But this has been going on since last week. So it's the A421, and it's near the Marshleys roundabout to and from the M1 at Junction 13 for Bedford. And Northern Rail have problems at the moment between Middlesbrough and Darlington. Orna Merchant, Five Live Travel.
Orna, thanks very much indeed. It is Five Live Drive today with Johnny and Claire. Great to have your company. How positive,
amazing,
wonderful and uplifting were Mike Peters and his wife Jules.
Yeah. It's a cliche thing to say, isn't it? But when you talk about inspiration,
yeah,
you think about your life and the little things you start whining about and the little things that get you down, and then you meet someone like him, just effervescent still.
And they have both been through so much.
Yeah.
Stephen Redland's been in touch. Afternoon, Steve. He says, Mike and Jules sound like me and my wife. I've got myeloma and she's been through two breast cancers. Their story on the Alarm website is really helpful. Please wish them continued good health, and I hope to see them on the road soon. Last time I saw the Alarm was at the Hammersmith Odeon, and then Mike stopped the gig to tell the security to be more gentle. What a guy. And this is Phil in Shropshire, who messaged earlier. He actually said, I'm going to also do a meet and greet with Mike. I cannot wait to see him. And this Department 26 at the Christie Hospital is staffed by heroes. They are amazing, says Bill, another grateful Christie patient. So big up the Christie.
Also, big up the Christie. On the topic of, we'd like to hear from you today about the things that are broken or damaged.
Yes.
Maybe damaged is a better way of describing it.
Why are you changing your tune then?
Just because somebody's had a go at me on the text saying you should
read it out, Johnny.
Yeah.
Front them up.
It can't be broken and it's still being not used. Maybe, and it's still being used. Damaged would be a better phrase, Johnny. We can make do amend items rather than just chuck it away. We don't have endless resources. Stephen Skipton.
Well, I think Steve's got a point.
Of course he's got a point. That's why I've read it out.
Yeah.
Speaking the truth.
I'm with you, Steve.
I'm a keen cyclist, guys, and I have a favourite pair of cycling shoes. They're 15 years old and held together by gaffer tape and some toe warmers. Ooh. I bought several new pairs, but I love these old shoes and I just can't bring myself to throw them away, says Carl in Church Stretton.
Jeff in Cardiff says, I inadvertently got one prong of my garden fork the wrong side of a paving slab whilst lifting this year's potatoes. Currently cooking some of them in a potato soup. Yum. And it's now at a 90-degree angle to the rest. Found out you only need three prongs.
There you go.
Says Jeff. There you go. Orna, what have you got?
Oh, I've got my glasses.
Yeah.
Here they are.
Are they totally done in?
Well, I have another. They are without the sellotape, aren't they? They are like Jack Duckworth without the sellotape. I don't know how I've bent them. I don't even know how they're still going, but they do still work.
Yeah, you kind of don't look too crazy in those.
Thanks, Claire.
Fine. We can get a double seat on a bus quite a lot. So anyway, what have you got that's damaged, not broken?
Damaged,
get the vernacular right, and you don't want to part with it. This is a survey out today that says, I don't know, some statistics on broken phones.
1 in 10 phones have a broken screen.
Yeah, and we keep using them, and so we should.
Mm.
So we should. 85058.
This is all smoke and mirrors. That's sales.
On BBC iPlayer.
What have you got to offer me?
Look, this isn't all of our interests, right?
The new series of Industry.
I'm so glad you came.
Starring Kit Harington.
I'm an investment banker. Did you invite me here to watch you eat?
No, I invited you here to seduce you.
I've never met anyone with a bigger blind spot.
All's fair in love and war, right?
I needed my friend and you used me.
Industry.
Now, we go to work.
Starts tomorrow on BBC iPlayer.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
8 minutes past five. It's Claire and Johnny with you this afternoon. Now, there will be two significant moments in the UK's decarbonisation efforts today.
Yes, the last coal-fired power station at Ratcliffe-on-Soar in Nottinghamshire is closing tonight. After six, we're going to be hearing from Sherwood writer James Graham, who wants to save the iconic cooling towers.
Meanwhile, the last blast furnace at the Port Talbot Steelworks is being shut down, ending Virgin Steel production at the site. Let's speak to our Wales correspondent, Thomas Morgan. Afternoon to you, Thomas. Just set the scene for us. Why is this happening and the shutdown itself potentially causing a lot of lost jobs?
Well, I mean, Tata Steel have been saying consistently for quite some time now that their Port Talbot plant is losing them £1 million a day. So when you couple that with the fact that the Batalbert plant was, up until very recently, the biggest single emitter of carbon in the UK, it's now second, you know, things had to change. So they have made the decision to close the final blast furnace there, which was coming to an end anyway. They made the decision to close it now, and with it, because the blast furnace is the labour-intensive part of creating the iron ore, so goes so many jobs. Around 2,500 will go. Now, some of them may move to other parts of the business. Other people might take voluntary redundancies in other locations across South Wales, maybe over in Llanelli, in Trostro, Llanwern, in Newport, but the majority of them will go. There has been a fund set up by the government, and the unions have set up shop in the local shopping centre for people to go to reskill and to find other jobs elsewhere. But for the short to medium term, yes, there will be job losses. And what will come in its place? There has been an investment of £1.25 billion, £500 million coming from the government, the rest coming from Tata Steel, to build an electric arc furnace. And that'll be far greener because the power to generate it will, of course, come from, hopefully, renewables down the line. But that will take 4 or 5 years to be built, and it can only recycle steel. So we're talking about, you know, 4 or 5 years, the end of this decade. And actually, when it is built, it needs a far smaller workforce for it to operate. Mm. So, you know, within the community, there's a lot of, there is some anger that Tata haven't held on to the blast furnace a little bit longer so that change of a period would be a little bit smoother when it comes to displacing some of the jobs. But some people in the community are happy because they say over the years they've suffered from the environmental impact of the site, and they're happier to see it close.
We're going to speak to a shift manager in just a moment's time, but what number of jobs are we expecting to go, Thomas?
I think it's around 2,500, and I was speaking to one of the reps and one of the unions earlier today, who I've met several times over the past 10 years. It's almost every other year we've been down there, really, and it seems as though the writing has been on the wall for the steelworks there. And he was in tears today because he has worked as hard as he possibly can to save as many jobs as possible. And he has worked in this part of the plant that's closing, and it's just closed now, actually, today. And he knows that his friends' jobs are on the line and probably will lose their jobs. And he doesn't really have the answers for many of their wives that have been contacting him recently. So a really sad day for many of them.
We've heard from multiple politicians along the way of this, both the former government and the current government. What's the latest? What are local national politicians talking about today?
Well, they put this fund together to help the transition period for those people to be reskilled or to use their skills in other industries. There is that fund also for the supply chain, because across South Wales, of course, there's a number of other businesses other than Tata that use the steel to make other products as well. So could some move into there, or does the money need to prop up some of those businesses as they diversify as well, really? I think for Labour and the unions, they say the deal they managed to strike with Tata recently is slightly better than the one the Tories struck with Tata a couple of months ago. But in reality, I think everybody knew it was going to be wholly unlikely and impossible for all these jobs to be saved, because Tata wanted to close the blast furnace because they said they were losing so much money. It was coming to the end of their lifespan. And there are environmental and carbon goals to reach as well.
Mm. Thanks very much, Thomas. That's the latest from our Wales correspondent, Thomas Morgan. Well, at the heart of this are the people whose jobs are at risk and the communities being affected. Stuart Phillips is one of those, a shift manager at the steelworks for the iron and burdening department. And Stuart, welcome to the programme. You've worked for Tata Steel for 27 years.
Yes, good evening. Yeah, that's correct. I've been here from 1997. Started as an apprentice back, what only seems like yesterday, but ultimately I've been here for 27 years. And here on the final day of iron and steel making within our plant in its current capacity.
I mean, I imagine it's been really difficult to get your head around. How are you feeling right now?
Yeah, it's quite a mixed emotion. A day full of mixed emotions, I'm honest with you. It's quite a somber, quite a sad feeling. We're reminiscing over some of the memories and the past, and what the future looks like and the way forward. So it's it's quite an emotional day really for everybody involved throughout the plant.
The steel industry is pretty much all you've known. You won't be alone in that. There's thousands of people there that will be in a similar position to you. They don't know what they're going to do next. What kind of impact is this going to have, not just on those families, but the surrounding communities as a whole?
Well, I think it's going to have a huge impact, especially on the Super Talbot and the surrounding valleys and further afield. Up to sort of the Rhondda, there's people whom work within Tata Steel that travel as far as Bristol. So I think the knock-on effect is going to be huge for the local area and the wider community.
Do you understand, Stuart, why this is happening? And I mean that in a sense that obviously Tata have said, look, we're losing around £1 million a day and there is this push for being far more environmentally friendly. Apparently the shift to new furnaces could cut UK emissions by about 2% if renewable electricity is used instead. Do you appreciate the decision making behind that?
Oh yes, I think that you won't find a steelworker who doesn't understand or doesn't appreciate where the business is going. I think the government set a strategy out to reduce carbon emissions by 35% by 2035 and to be net zero by 2050. So I think every steelworker will agree that the transition to green steel is the right move. It's the way in which to secure the longevity of the business. It just seems to have happened rather quickly. But there's nobody here who would disagree with the reason behind it or the motives for it.
I mean, you seem very, very philosophical about this, Stuart. You don't know what's happening to you yet, as I understand it, but there is a chance maybe that you could be redeployed or get a job somewhere else within the company, is there?
Yes, well, I'm quite optimistic. The fact that I've worked hard, I've worked through from the shop floor, and I like to think I'm well respected and thought of well within the business. So I'm still hoping to remain employed within Tata. It's provided me with an excellent lifestyle and an excellent life for my previous 27 years, and hopefully there's some longevity left in it yet, but it's still a very sad day. There's still a lot of uncertainty in and around the business, and more certainly the personnel whom are still working here.
Yeah, and that going through any change professionally is always one of the most difficult things to deal with, is just that not knowing. This new electrification is going to be a big investment in the company, about £1.25 billion, £500 million coming in government subsidies. So the company is obviously very, very committed to this. And I guess there could be opportunities at least. You know, we know there's redeployment, Stuart, but as with ever, when there is change, there is potentially opportunities. And, it sounds like you are hopeful of those that will provide something for you and those other impacted steelworkers.
Yes, well, certainly. I think you've got to remain optimistic. You've got to look at the positives, really, rather than the negatives. And I think the investment from both Tata and the government have ensured that there'll still be some steelmaking capacity in South Wales, in a different way than what we've been used to.
I guess, nevertheless, though, the problem is it's going to be way more efficient and less, labour intensive, so there will be nearly 3,000 people who are looking for a job at the end of this process.
That's it. And there's a lot of uncertainty, most certainly around the people who work here, myself included, as to what the future does look like. There's no guarantees as of yet. And I think being made redundant at this time within this area is a big concern for a lot of people and a lot of my colleagues.
Yeah. Well, Stuart, thank you very much for spending a bit of time with us on your last day. I hope you've got some lovely memories, and I hope that actually you can find something else within the company or whatever happens. But yeah, really appreciate that time with us this afternoon on the programme. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Stuart Phillips there, shift manager at the steelworks at Tata Steel. 18 minutes past five.
Now,
Hello. Now, as we mentioned earlier, family members of hostages in Gaza have given a press conference this afternoon in London as they prepare to mark a year since the kidnap of their loved ones on October the 7th last year. This is Steve Brisley, who's spoken in the last hour. His brother-in-law, Eli, was amongst those taken by Hamas.
People forget that October 7th was not an act of war. It was an act of terrorism. The indiscriminate killing and kidnapping of civilians. 39 different nationalities, Jews, Muslims, Christians, Hindus and Buddhists. So please don't tell me that this was about politics or religion or nations. This was about savagery and evil. And the hostages are innocents. So I call upon all governments, upon my government, to do better, to do more, to bring them home.
And Steve will be joining us here on Drive just after 5.30.
And we'll be speaking to Emmy and PGA award-winning writer, producer and director Tony Gerber, whose latest documentary, War Game, asked the question, what if you had 6 hours to save democracy? That interview coming up just before six.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network. 5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's Johnny and Claire with you on Drive. Thanks for joining us. In a month's time, history will be made when Rachel Reeves gives the first budget speech by a female chancellor. It isn't expected to be an easy one, of course, as the government has warned there will be difficult decisions to come on taxes, spending and on the welfare state as well. So what could be in the chancellor's sights as she prepares the budget? Our business reporter Peter Ruddock has spent the day in Leeds, the city where Rachel Reeves is an MP, and Peter's still there. Peter, you still buy a beer tap or a move location?
Afternoon, Claire. I've moved away from the beer tap and away from the rain, and I've moved actually into the Ideas Factory. This is the room I'm in here in Fast Signs. They're a company, been in Leeds for 29 years. They make business signs for pretty much any business, shopfront, van you can imagine. Really interesting to chat to them because they get a real idea of how businesses are doing at the moment because they work with all sorts of sectors. So it should be an interesting chat. I've escaped the beer.
Oh, poor you. Now, listen, I mean, we can all speculate as much as we want, but do we have any kind of, the kind of grand plan, any idea of what Rachel Reeves might say? We've heard a lot about the £20 billion black hole, but what's she going to fill it with?
Well, we know at least some of the things that aren't going to happen, don't we? Because the Chancellor has constrained herself ever so slightly with those promises on income tax, on VAT and national insurance contributions. And we know, as I said about an hour ago, that it becomes quite a difficult task if you're going to keep to your self-imposed fiscal rules about sort of debt targets and things like that. There are some hints that maybe she'll tweak those rules, and that might make what is going to be a difficult job potentially a little bit easier. In terms of what we will actually hear, you know, I'm afraid it is going to be a bit of speculation central for the next few weeks as sort of things get floated and then people in the press that say that's awful and then suddenly the idea disappears away. But we could be looking at things like capital gains tax. That's a tax on the profit of the sale of things. So things like second homes, pieces of art, company shares, potentially a tax sort of going up in those areas. Inheritance tax obviously could be in the headlights. That's, you know, paid on some of the assets of people who've died. We could be talking about making the tax relief on money paid into private pension pots a bit less attractive. The controversial one I was chatting an hour or so ago about is fuel duty, because that's been frozen for quite a while and then it was cut by 5p a couple of years ago. That was supposed to be temporary, that cut, but it's still here. And those things would go, we think, probably to pay for more money for childcare and, of course, towards the NHS. But the reality is we are still early days and I'm afraid the speculation is going to continue.
Yeah, you've been in Leeds then. You've been asking people what they want to hear. What have they been telling you?
Well, of course, one of the biggest decisions has already been made, and of course, the most controversial, really, which is to means test the winter fuel payment. We caught up, as you say, Rachel Reeves represents a constituency here in Leeds, so we went along to her constituency to gauge opinions on that very controversial decision.
The winter fuel payments, I don't think's very good that she's cutting that. I've got neighbours that are all on pension credit and, you know, the elderly, and I just wonder how they're going to survive this winter.
I mean, I'm lucky because I've got a partner,
who's working. But I would find it very difficult on my pension paying all my bills, you know what I mean? So I'm very lucky in that respect.
Protecting those most vulnerable, yes, the younger families included, and yeah, I would put more tax on those who are super rich and have got extra in the bank.
I can see that you really want benefits to be aimed at those who are the poorest and the most at need. So it's a crude way of doing it, and I feel very sorry for those people who are just over, and people like myself will lose out as a result of that. But we too have got to bear our share of it, and there are many people who are pensioners who are receiving benefits they don't need, and I think we need to redirect them towards those people who need it most.
There's been a lot of discussion about that winter fuel payment, and of course there's been a lot of discussion about what does get announced in the budget, because we're going to learn a bit more about other policies, not just that particular one. As I said, I'm in the Ideas Factory, so I've come nearer to the city centre now to Fast Signs in Leeds. They've been here for 29 years making signs for business. We're stood at a table where people will design their signs, and I've got a colour wheel in front of me, and it's got all of these different colours and what they sort of psychologically do. So black, I'm told, is associated with power, which is why I never wear it. Purple is about stability. This is very interesting. Andy is with me. You're the boss here, Andy. You'll be talking businesses through designing their signs and making their business sort of look, if you like, which is really important.
Yep.
Before we heard that bit of audio, I was talking about some of the things that might get announced in the budget. We know there are difficult decisions. Any thoughts on any of those things I mentioned? Would they impact you? Because, you know, there is a chance that with difficult decisions, some people are going to be impacted negatively.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. I mean, we want to see a pro-small business, you know, with 5.5 million small businesses under 50 employees in the UK. We want to not have our costs increase too much. Worried about I want the government to encourage us to employ people, so we don't want lots of extra red tape or extra costs. We don't have a HR department.
You're the HR department.
Yeah.
Basically.
So we do have help from, but we don't have our own internal department, so if there's extra red tape, that's just an extra cost. The corporation tax, I'd like to see that capped at 25%, if not come down for smaller businesses. Maybe, you know, for businesses under 100,000, 200,000 profit, maybe that's lower, because it makes a big difference to us if we want to reinvest next year in equipment or people. 25% of our profits, you know, can be a big amount. We reinvest a lot of the money. We don't go out and buy yachts. Most small business owners aren't buying flash cars and yachts. You know, we're just employing people from the local economy, and we're really proud that we've employed a lot of people over the last 29 years. I want to see the cost. You know, I don't want our costs eroded and the profit eroded.
But someone's costs somewhere are going to be going up,
yes,
aren't they?
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah,
so
where
would you like the axe to fall then?
Where would I like the axe to fall? Well, it's hard to say, isn't it? I mean, because there's lots of things. You know, I want help with the sustainability and environment, and also being able to change our practices to be more sustainable. So it's hard to pinpoint somebody. And
but not the smaller businesses.
Not the smaller business. I think there's so many in this country.
Andy, thank you so much for this. Let me leave you with a couple of other. Blue is the colour of sky associated with depth and stability, trust, loyalty and wisdom. Perhaps I should start wearing blue, Johnny and Claire. What do you think?
I'd go for the royal purple instead, actually.
What does that one mean?
It's royalty purple, isn't it? Well, as a texter here says, papal purple. Not PayPal, not the online payment portal. That's something different.
PayPal.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's a man who carries off knitwear and in a variety of colours, so, you know.
Purple, also luxury and ambition, Claire and Johnny, yeah, as well.
Well,
as
it suits you perfectly then, doesn't it?
Sure.
That is you.
You to a T. Peter, thanks very much. Are you sticking around in Leeds for us?
A little bit longer, but a month to go until the budget, so big decisions, so lots of things to talk about.
Thank you for joining us. Peter Ruddock, our business reporter in Leeds.
Let's get a bit of Strictly news now. The actress Amanda Abington says she feels vindicated by the findings of a BBC review of the complaints she made about her Strictly Come Dancing partner Giovanni Pannicci. The BBC review upheld some of Amanda Abington's complaints, but cleared Giovanni of the most serious allegations. Charlotte Moore is the BBC's chief content officer.
So I want to apologise to Amanda that she did not have a positive experience on Strictly. Obviously, you know, one has to remember over the 20 years, you know, of Strictly's lifetime, you know, this has been a positive experience for the majority of people who've been on Strictly. So I do want to apologise on behalf of the BBC to Amanda, and I also want to thank her for having the courage to come forward. You know, this is not an easy thing to do, to come forward and to make a complaint, a formal complaint. I think, you know, I do want to thank her for that. But at the same time, I do need to be really clear that this is a confidential process, so I'm not able to go into the specifics.
Well, let's get the latest from our entertainment correspondent, Lizo Mazumba, who joins us now. Afternoon to you, Lizo.
Hello.
Just set out exactly what has been decided by the BBC, because it seems that both parties involved in this are kind of claiming a victory or vindication.
Well, the BBC put out a statement earlier today, and all they really said in quite a lengthy statement, getting to the centre of the issue, is saying, we've assessed the complaints made by Amanda Abington and we have upheld some, but not all of the complaints made. We want to apologise to Amanda Abington and to thank her for coming forward and taking part. We know this would not have been an easy thing to do. Now, as I was just saying, only some of the complaints were upheld. The BBC understands that the complaints that were upheld involved verbal bullying and harassment, but complaints about physical aggression were not upheld. As you say, Amanda Abington issued a statement earlier today and she said, I've never regretted coming forward and today's apology from the BBC is a vindication of my complaint. It's not just a vindication for me, it's a vindication for the other people who've contacted me since I made my complaint to express concerns about their own experiences on Strictly Come Dancing. I hope those who felt unable to speak out now will be more confident they'll be listened to and believed. And in the last 10 minutes or so, we've also had a statement from Giovanni Panizza. He said, I'm glad the review has finally come to an end. I'm relieved that the allegations that I was threatening and abusive were found not to be true. The majority of the false allegations have been thrown out by the review. It's been an extremely difficult year reading story after story and not being able to say anything in return, as I respected the integrity of the review, which the BBC asked everyone to do. So yes, you know, both sides in a way trying to claim victory, but I think the fact remains, and the headline is that 6 complaints, including complaints about verbal bullying and harassment, were upheld against Giovanni Panizza, and I think that's behaviour that everyone recognises is not permissible in the workplace, in any workplace.
I haven't heard the full interview with Charlotte Moore, the BBC's chief content officer, but there was a talk for a long time in the lead up to this about the videotapes that apparently the BBC have kept of the sessions, the rehearsal sessions, and many people saying, well, look, wouldn't it all just be put to bed if they released a video and everybody could see what had happened? Was there any talk of those at all?
Well, yes, but Charlotte Moore was very keen to emphasise that they can't go into detail about the investigation. They can't go into things that impinge on the confidentiality of the actual investigation and people's private information. And as we've seen going forward, you know, the BBC have said that in the future they will have individual chaperones in all of the training sessions right throughout the week. We don't know quite what happened in the past, if everything was videoed or not.
And finally, Lizo, the show's underway. There was no mention of it at any point during the show, I think. Certainly the opening episode. Is that it? Is it put to bed now, do you think? Will the show be able to move on without more conversations around this?
I think so. I think the BBC will be keen to separate out the show itself as a piece of entertainment and the story about this report, which has been, you know, waited for many, many weeks and quite a few months now. I'd be very surprised if they made any kind of reference to it on the show, because the show, what they want to do is just say, we want to entertain people with this incredibly popular show celebrating its 20th year. Anything about talking about this report summary that's come out today, I can't see any advantage to the BBC in drawing more attention to it by talking about it on Strictly on Saturday night.
OK, Lizo, thank you. That's Lizo Mazumba there, our entertainment correspondent on the latest on Strictly. Just gone 5:30.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Here are the headlines at 5.30. Hezbollah says it's ready to respond to an expected ground invasion into Lebanon by Israel. CBS News is reporting Israel has told the US it plans to start a limited incursion. Following a series of recent airstrikes, the Israeli defence minister met troops near the border earlier. As you've been hearing, the BBC has apologised to Amanda Abington after upholding some of the complaints she made about her Strictly Come Dancing partner Giovanni Pannice. It's understood claims of verbal bullying and harassment against the professional dancer were upheld, but he was cleared of the most serious allegations. The former Prime Minister Liz Truss has told the Conservative Party conference those wanting to become the next Tory leader need to acknowledge how bad things are. Kimmy Badenoch and Tom Tugendhat have addressed members at the event today before James Cleverly and Robert Jenrick get their chance tomorrow. And the UK's top civil servant, Simon Case, is leaving his job as Cabinet Secretary. He's stepping down at the end of the year after revealing he's been receiving treatment for a neurological condition. That's the news. Della's here with the sport.
Thank you. Arsenal defender Jurrien Timber says the current fixture schedule is dangerous and is a big topic in the dressing room. The Dutchman says he agrees with Manchester City defender Rodri and Liverpool goalkeeper Alisson's assessment that there are too many games. Well, ahead of tomorrow's Champions League match against Paris Saint-Germain, Timber says players are definitely more at risk of a serious injury as a result of the schedule.
And I think it's a really good thing that the players are speaking out now. Let the voices hear. It doesn't look like it's getting any less at the moment. So we're trying to be there every game and give our best. But it gets hard if the games are like coming and coming, especially in England without having a winter break. I think it's really hard.
Meanwhile, Arsenal boss Mikel Arteta says Ricardo Calafiori will be assessed before tomorrow's match. The fullback suffered a knee problem in Saturday's win over Leicester. Ben White will also have a late fitness test. That match tomorrow against PSG is live on 5 Live. Southampton will try at the sixth attempt to get their first win of the Premier League season tonight. They're away at Bournemouth. Victory would move Saints out of the relegation zone. Their manager Russell Martin says the match gives him the opportunity to use some of his squad players.
The more games, the better for our squad right now, because we have a lot of guys that are not even on the bench on a Saturday, which is the hardest part of it right now. And they're good players. They're really top players. And some of them have been brilliant for us and played such a big part in getting us here. So to leave them out of the squad is not easy. So the more opportunity we can get for them to be on the pitch to keep everyone ready, then the better for us.
Leeds and Wales have suffered a major injury blow, with midfielder Ethan Ampadu set to be sidelined for the rest of the year with knee ligament damage. Leeds boss Daniel Farke says the midfielder won't need surgery, but he's expecting it to be at least 10 weeks before Ampadu can return to training. Germany women's captain Alexandra Popp has announced she'll retire from international football next month. The 33-year-old made her Germany debut in 2010. She's scored 67 goals for her country in 144 appearances. And British tennis player Sonia Cartel is hoping to continue her rise up the world rankings, despite fearing in January that she wouldn't be able to play again this season because of a health issue. The 22-year-old, however, instead enjoyed the best season of her career, reaching the Wimbledon third round, winning her first WTA title a fortnight ago and breaking into the world's top 100.
People were saying, like, you know, you've reached top 100, like, you can kind of chill out. But I was like, no, like, I always want to push for the next best thing. So, yeah, it will be just trying to get as high as those and see if I can even go top 80, top 70 by kind of December.
And some sad news from the world of basketball to bring you. The NBA have announced the death of Hall of Famer Dikembe Mutombo at the age of 58 from brain cancer. The Congolese American was renowned as one of the best defensive players in NBA history. He was an 8-time NBA All-Star and passed away surrounded by his family. That's the latest from BBC Sport.
New travel news, and the A1M in Nottinghamshire heading north at junction 34 for Blyth is blocked because of an accident. So there is a queue showing there on the speed sensors. We've got heavy, persistent rain. It means localised flooding, particularly in the northwest and most of Yorkshire. The M80 Falkirk on the southbound side at junction 7 at the Hags. It's taking about half an hour. Stop, start traffic. At Merseyside, it's the M57 near Switch Island. So that's northbound at junction 7. Stop, start there. Then we've got queues on the M62 in West Yorkshire heading west. Chain Bar backing up to Gildersham at the moment. So 26 back to junction 27. That's after a breakdown. You've had heavy traffic on the A14. A vehicle broke down. One lane closed at the Catthorpe interchange. That's joining the M1 near junction 19 of the M1. And they're still trying to pump all of that flood water away on the A421. So that's near the A6 of the Marshallese roundabout, but it's to and from the M1 at junction 13 for Bedford. The M25 anti-clockwise, 13 at Staines. Debris was left there. It's caused queues back to the M4. That's at junction 15 anti-clockwise. There are queues as well, just around the M25, mainly across the top where the roadworks are at junction 25. That's both directions. directions. And on the train, signal problems affecting Northern Rail and Transpennine. So it's Middlesbrough services in the main. Orna Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
Stay there, Orna. James in Rushton has been in touch. He says, hi, guys. This is completely irrelevant to anything, but I've been listening to the programme for years and not long ago... Or was it when I realised Orna does the travel at the end of the travel? I've always thought she says more to mention, but of course she's saying Orna Merchant.
More to mention.
Years.
Works well.
Years. More to mention. There you go,
that's
Jane.
Me trying to rush my name to get out.
There quick, you go.
I think.
Thank you, James. Thanks for getting in touch. And thanks everybody who's got in touch after the Mike Peters interview, frontman of The Alarm, of course, and his wonderful wife, Jules. Charlie's been in touch. Just caught the end of the interview with Mike Peters of The Alarm. I lived many years in Prestatyn, and Mike and his lovely wife were quite the local celebrities. I've had 3 swells of cancer, bowel and prostate, and had chemo, radio, and very recently major surgery. I am still here like Mike due to the wonderful efforts of the NHS. Charlie, thank you very much for that. And listen to this. The programme that he's on at the Christie is called the Stella Research Programme. So great to hear that feature about Stella. I used to work on that study.
Wow.
And it feels so good to hear how well he is doing, heading home from work with a big smile on my face, says Joe. We salute you, Joe.
Fantastic.
Brilliant.
Also on the topic of damaged things that you just cannot let go of.
Yeah.
Because 1 in 10 of us had damaged phone screens, apparently. I've got an old tease made. Oh, tease made.
I'd love one of those.
Ask
generation game.
Kids. Ask your parents. I've got an old tease made that my mum got me. The kettle and the alarm's knackered, but the light still works and it makes a lovely lamp. Dylan in Manchester.
Oh,
love
Dylan,
that.
How creative. And M in Stretford. Hi, Johnny. Hi, Claire. Damaged phone screens. If one, M's talking about one, maybe not yourself, M, has a very thick, big, wiry beard, get your screen replaced. It is very, very painful when your beard gets caught in the crack of the phone screen.
Excellent.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
Brilliant, Em. Thank you for that. 85058. When have you hung on to stuff that is damaged because you simply can't let it go?
Europe's elite club competition.
The Champions League. Right here on BBC Radio 5 Live. On Tuesday at 8.
Arsenal host PSG.
Wednesday at 8.
Aston Villa take on Bayern Munich.
Tielemans waiting. Control, driven shot, bottom corner.
And watch highlights of every single match with Match of the Day. Wednesday night on BBC iPlayer.
The Champions League.
On 5 Live.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Johnny Anson and Claire McDonald with you. Family members of hostages in Gaza have given a news conference in London as they prepare to mark a year since the kidnap of their loved ones on October the 7th. Earlier, the families, who are either British citizens or have strong ties to the UK, had a meeting with the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer. Steve Brisley was one of those who spoke about his brother-in-law at the news conference.
51 weeks have passed since the attack. 51 weeks since my family was torn apart. 51 weeks since Ellie was taken. That's more than a football season, more than an academic year. We've cycled through all 4 seasons. We've changed governments. All of these things while Ellie and the other hostages have been held underground in tunnels, tied up, in cells, in cages, in filth, malnourished, injured, sick, and some tortured, and some murdered. People forget that October 7th was not an act of war. It was an act of terrorism. The indiscriminate killing and kidnapping of civilians. 39 different nationalities. Jews, Muslims, Christians, Hindus and Buddhists. So please don't tell me that this was about politics or religion or nations. This was about savagery and evil. And the hostages are innocents. So I call upon all governments, upon my government, to do better, to do more, to bring them home.
Tragically, Steve's sister, Leanne, and his nieces, Noya and Yahel, were killed on the 7th of October. And Steve joins us now. Welcome back, Steve.
Evening, Claire.
Thanks so much for talking to us. I appreciate maybe a lot of what was said in that meeting with the Prime Minister is confidential, but what can you tell us?
Well, I think it was a case of us trying to make clear that we need something more from the government. The the fact that we've reached nearly the year anniversary since Ellie and all the rest of the hostages were taken, and a deal, a hostage release deal, has still not been achieved, is an abject failure of international diplomacy. Clearly, whatever has been done up until this point has not worked. Now, the previous government and this current administration have offered us reassurance they're doing everything they can. That's the common quote, everything they can to secure the release of the hostages. But I think we've reached a stage where we need something new. We need something different. I mean, it's the sunk cost fallacy of doing the same thing and not wanting to abandon that approach. So what I did say to the Prime Minister and to the Foreign Secretary is that we need something new, we need something innovative, we need something to change, because what's gone before has not worked.
Did you hear anything in the conversation you had today that makes you feel that something new could be suggested, something new could be tried?
The Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary made it clear that it's an ever-changing situation, and that is part of the problem, that any time something new might be tried, the situation changes like grains of sand. So I do appreciate that it is a very fluid and difficult situation to be in. That said, as I said, I called upon them to do more and do something different. I don't get the impression that there is anything new or innovative that immediately is springing to their minds. So we just have to hope that whatever it is that goes on behind closed doors, which is clearly confidential, that does bear some fruit. But the fact of the matter is that the UK is not in the room as far as negotiations are concerned. It's Hamas, it's Israel, it's Egypt, Qatar, and to one extent or another, the US. The UK are not currently in the room, so are not entirely party to those conversations. And so I do question what influence they can have.
And did they give you did the Prime Minister say anything as to why that might not be the case?
No, I mean, the previous government had said it was essentially a policy decision, not to be in the room. And we've had conversations with ministers more recently where they've explained to us that having additional people in the room is not seen as helpful. Now, I'm not a politician or a diplomat, but clearly the stakeholders that are in the room and have been in the room have not been able to get this over the line. So it gets the point of I'm willing to try anything now. I'm willing for my government to try anything to get this deal done so that we can get Ellie home alive.
We're approaching the year anniversary, and we've spoken several times, Steve, over the last year. As that nears, it'll be a significant milestone for everybody in your family. How is everybody bearing up?
It's a cliche, but it's a living nightmare every day. I suppose we've moved past the visceral, raw emotions of the first few weeks and first couple of months, and we just all try to get to the stage where maybe it's only the second thing we think about when we wake up each morning. But most days, it's the first thing you think about, and it's always there. There are always reminders. It's all over social media. It's all over the press to one degree or another. Not necessarily about the original attack, and certainly not about the hostages, but the wider situation in Israel. And it's a constant burden. It's a constant weight on our shoulders where we just want to be able to grieve for our lost family. I've been unable to grieve properly for Leanne, Noya and Yahel because the situation with Ellie remains unresolved. And whilst I've had to sort of begin the grieving process for my sister and my nieces, it's not possible to fully engage with that until Ellie is back home alive. It's the one chink of light that we've got from this entire nightmare.
And briefly, Steve, obviously things are escalating as far as Israel has said. We understand that they are going to start a ground incursion into Lebanon. How does that leave you feeling with regard to how the hostage situation may potentially now be put on the back burner because they have other more pressing events that they are spearheading at the moment?
I mean, obviously, we appreciate that the wider Middle East conflict is an important global issue. But I take a very perhaps selfish approach to this. That it's just another delay. There's been delays because of the deal and the renegotiation of the deal. There's been delays because of the Iranian attack. There was a delay because of the UK election. Now there's going to be a delay because of the US election. The escalation in Lebanon clearly has an impact and changes the focus and changes takes attention away from the hostages. The Israeli government have long said that the hostages are their number one priority. I'm not seeing anything that suggests that that is in fact the case. So quite how we refocus them on the hostage situation, I'm not too sure. But that's why we've been doing what we're doing today, is to try and refocus and trying to remind people that there are still hostages there, despite the fact that the wider Middle East conflict is obviously a concern for everyone.
Steve, thank you so much for taking time out to talk to us on what is a very important day for you and your family. And I'm sure we'll talk again. Steve Brisley there, who is representing his brother-in-law, Ellie, who is still being held captive in Gaza. 11 minutes to 6.
We are going to keep across, of course, the situation between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. The US has observed positioning of Israeli troops that suggests a ground incursion into Lebanon could be imminent. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bechega is in Beirut.
They believe that they have the momentum now to degrade Hezbollah quite significantly, to again change the situation along the border. They say that the goal of this operation is to allow the return of those 60,000 residents who've been displaced because of those rockets that have been fired by Hezbollah. So very difficult to see how any kind of diplomatic solution can be found right now.
In the UK, the government has said this evening that it's doing everything we can to help Britons flee Lebanon. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has chaired a meeting of the COBRA Emergency Committee to discuss the crisis.
There's an estimated 5,000 British citizens in Lebanon, and the government says it's working on all contingency options. British ministers and officials have stressed that Britain should leave Lebanon immediately. Just after 6, we'll be speaking to Dan Harper, who's a Brit trying to get out of Beirut. 10 to 6 now.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live,
the voice of the UK.
5 Live Drive. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now, earlier in the show, we heard about the BBC Microbit Playground Survey. It records how active kids are when they're in school using a tiny computer, which pupils have programmed themselves. The survey shows they're stationary more than half the time at school, but it's also given children a crash course in coding and computing. Here's what some of them thought about the project.
It was really fun using it because it was on Fridays and computing were one of my favourite lessons.
I think it was really fun and it got me to know more about what computers and technology can do.
Well, joining us now is Leanne Findon, a computing teacher. Hi, Leanne.
Hi.
So you've been using this with your kids. Tell us what the experience has been like.
The children have really enjoyed our experience with the microbits. We took part in the playground survey so we could get some more use out of them. And the children responded to it really, really well. They loved coding on the computers, moving on from scratch, which is what we normally use in our coding lessons, to be able to code the physical device they thought was amazing.
Yeah.
And being involved in the survey really gave them a purpose for doing it.
Why is it important that children so young learn about coding and technology?
Well, not only is there a lot of careers now in technology and in coding, it's also about problem solving. So it's about the children being able to spot errors in the things that they do and being able to problem solve. So we teach coding across the whole of the computer curriculum, right down from reception all the way until they leave in year 6. And the idea of that is to embed this planning process and this problem solving process, as well as obviously giving them skills to actually be able to code a small program.
Yeah, I mean, technology is such an essential part of everybody's life now that to grow up without learning the basics, I guess, would mean that you can't really understand the world around you as well as you need to. What did the children think of the results of this? We heard from a few earlier who were quite surprised at how much they were sat around.
They were. It was one of the activities they did, they had to wear the microbits on their wrist and they went out into the playground. That part of the study was actually pre-coded for them. They didn't write that code, but they went out into the playground wearing these microbits and then they attached the microbits back to the computer and they looked at their results. And their results showed that they were a lot more sedentary than they were expecting to be. And I think that was well, it was definitely a surprise for the children.
Yeah.
To the point where, to start off with, they were saying, "Oh, I don't think it's working correctly." But after right. when we sat and talked about it, they are actually like, "Well, yeah, actually, I did stand around talking about what game I was going to play, and actually, I did spend a period of my lunch obviously eating,
yeah.
which involved me sitting down or queuing for my lunch, and they also spend quite a lot of time during games standing still.
Will like it if make them goal? Will it make them more active? It might make them coders. Will it make them more active? Do you think?
I think so, yes. I think some of them went away and were like, right, so when I'm having that conversation, I think I'm going to jog on the spot while I'm doing that. Right. So definitely have them more aware of what they were doing in the playground.
Yeah, well, everybody benefits. Lovely to talk to you, Leanne. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Leanne Findon, they're a computing teacher.
Still haven't managed to plug mine in. It's still there.
I've got the lights working on mine.
Yeah, but... you've got the light on. I've yet to get there, sadly. It's 6:07. Here's a question. What if you had 6 hours to save democracy? This is the question posed in a brilliant new documentary. It's called War Game. It's an elaborate simulation of a hypothetical coup after a disputed election. Sound familiar? The film follows a bipartisan group of political power players from different presidential administrations as they confront a political coup staged in the US, by US military members who reject the results of the 2024 presidential election. Tony Gerber is an Emmy and PGA award-winning writer, producer, director, and the co-writer and co-director of War Game. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely
happy to be here.
It's brilliant, this. So what you've done is take a real life situation and then simulate it. So talk us through the premise, because you use not actors, but people who have skin in this game, don't you?
Absolutely. You know, so it all began when three retired generals wrote an op-ed in The Washington Post. And these generals are sober characters, but they use some very alarming language. They said there's a threat for lethal chaos in the wake of the next contested election. And what they were pointing out was the rate at which far-right militias had been infiltrating active duty military and sheriff's departments and police departments all over the United States, right? So they saw this as clear and present danger. And in this op-ed, they basically put the challenge to the current administration to war game. And when you war game, basically, you know, you're imagining the unimaginable, and you do that so as not to be caught flat footed, which is what happened last January 6th, right?
Yeah.
So, the administration couldn't touch this with a 10-foot pole because of the partisan nature of politics in DC, right? So, in comes, an NGO called Vet Voice. Vet Voice took up the challenge. They reached out to their network of former elected officials, retired generals, folks from the intelligence community, to play the role of a president and his inner circle of advisors in the Situation Room on January 6, 2025. So it's a future set documentary.
And this is what you film. And we're,
this is what we film, yes.
We're in the Situation Room with these officials. I mean, it's a scary concept, clearly, but something that needs discussing, because clearly those generals who wrote that op-ed think that this is something serious to worry about. Without giving anything Absolutely. Away, talk us through what you found.
Well, I mean, what was extraordinary is that you had folks from different parties and of different political stripes working together. So our film, in the end, is a kind of rallying cry for reasoned leadership. And you mentioned that it's scary. And you know, Rolling Stone magazine said it's the scariest film of the year. And you know, as I contemplate, why is it so scary? It's because I think most people have no idea what a president does. And our film puts you in his shoes. It puts you at the table in the Situation Room thinking, what would I do in that situation? Right. And that's, I think, what's scary, because you realize how important reasoned leadership is. And if you have an impulsive, erratic, and frankly, intellectually lazy president, we're in a lot of trouble. And I think that's why people find this film so scary.
And those generals are talking about infiltration of state bodies, essentially, by far-right yes. militia. And they're saying it's already happening. So what do we know about
National Guard?
What do we know about that? I mean, what do we know what's being done about that?
Well, I mean, I can tell you, and you learn this in watching War Game, that because of the partisan nature of the legislature, it's been near impossible to get any sort of law passed. Because when one party says, you know, we need to look at active duty troops to see who's with us and who's a potential insurrectionist, it becomes a partisan issue. How dare you challenge the loyalty of our armed forces. You know, you can imagine that, right? Mm. But I can tell you that 2 weeks ago, we were invited to screen on Capitol Hill. Senator Tammy Duckworth invited the film. And there was a congressional aide in the audience at that screening who brought the film to her boss. And the film was then part of a armed forces committee hearing on the Hill. So, you know, little by little, I think that we're moving the dial. I mean, that's the hope.
That is an incredible thing to do, isn't it, really, with a piece of art in the way you've created it? I mean,
yes.
I guess what the film is saying is there is an enemy within, and maybe we saw some of that on January 6th last time. Are you hopeful that this will get taken seriously and further moves, actions will be made? Because we're already hearing from one side of the presidential debate that, you know, this could happen again. You know, you could it could be the big steal all over again. And there is concern that history could repeat itself.
Yes. And we were also told if you vote for me, you'll never have to vote again. You know, as if voting is a burden as opposed to a privilege, you know, and people have died for the right to vote, which is just absurd, right? That that the notion of you'll never have to vote again. So, you know, our film is a provocation for a conversation. It gets people talking in an extraordinary way. And it's a conversation that I think folks didn't realize that they needed to have.
Tony, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. And I know that people listening to this here in the UK can watch it on BBC Four.
That's right.
That's correct.
We broadcast tomorrow, October 1st, BBC Storyville.
Thank you so much for joining us. Tony Gerber there, Emmy and PGA award-winning writer, producer and director and co-writer and co-director of the film War Game, BBC Four, part of the Storyville season. It goes live tomorrow night. You're listening to Drive. Johnny Anson, Claire McDonnell with you. News is next.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
Here are your headlines at 6 o'clock on Monday, the 30th of September. Israel is reported to have told the United States it intends to launch a limited ground operation into Lebanon, potentially today. Earlier, the country's defence minister told troops they would use any means at their disposal to allow displaced people who fled Hezbollah rocket attacks in the north of Israel to return home. President Biden has been asked whether he was aware of Israel's plans.
I'm more aware than you might know, and I'm comfortable with them stopping. We should have a ceasefire now. Thank you.
In the last few minutes, we've heard National Education Union's members have voted to accept a pay rise for teachers in England. The government's offer offered an increase of 5.5%. An 8-year-old boy who died after being shot at a farm in Cumbria has been named as Jay Cartmel from Frizington. He was injured on land in the A66 on Saturday afternoon and later died in hospital. A man in his 60s who was being held on suspicion of gross negligence manslaughter has been released on bail. Professional dancer Giovanni Panice says he's relieved that he's been cleared of claims he was physically abusive to his celebrity partner on last year's Strictly Come Dancing. The BBC carried out a review of his behaviour after the actor Amanda Abington said she was subjected to inappropriate, mean and nasty bullying. The corporation has upheld some of her complaints and apologised. Our entertainment correspondent Lisa Mazimba has told Drive it's been a troubling time for the programme.
Both sides, in a way, trying to claim victory, but I think the fact remains, and the headline is that 6 complaints, including complaints about verbal bullying and harassment, were upheld against Giovanni Panice. And I think that's behaviour that everyone recognises is not permissible in the workplace.
This trust has accused the Conservative leadership contenders of failing to acknowledge how bad things are for the party. Speaking at the Tory conference in Birmingham, the former Prime Minister said the 4 people running to replace Rishi Sunak need to think more radically about some policies.